This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Jolly, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, we're talking about the politics of chocolate. We've got some exclusive polling which reveals the different chocolate preferences of different voters. We'll also look at the economics, because right now, cocoa is at a record high. And so we'll look at what that might mean the next time you're picking up your favourite chocolate bar. Before that, in the columnist James Marriott and Miranda Green on ending the sick note culture and infantilising young people. How people in their 20s still get treated like children. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits, live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. First on the pod, though, what we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that Nigel Farage isn't great at history.
I think if Winston Churchill came back and led the Conservative Party, it wouldn't really help their ratings very much.
Well, no, obviously not, because he won the Second World War and still lost the election. He was rubbish as a politician. We learned that Tory MP Mark Menzies is just like you or me.
This 78-year-old woman received this extraordinary call from him saying that he was locked in a flat and there were bad people and that they wanted £5,000 or they wouldn't release him.
Come on, we've all done it. We learned it from Matthew Paris. This was nothing new.
When I was a member of Parliament, I was cruising for sex on Clapham Common.
We learned that, yes, you can get a dog drunk, but you shouldn't.
I've found that dogs are more drawn to are things like Baileys, things that are creamy. Some dogs like the smell of beer.
There we are. We learned that someone has a book out which blames just about everyone.
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
We learned that it might also include Danny Finkelstein.
I actually helped her with a speech on the importance of the rule of law, and I now notice she's blocked me on Twitter.
We learned that Keir Starmer's got a copy.
I'm privileged to be the proud owner of a copy of the former Prime Minister's new book. It's a rare, unsigned copy.
We learned that Rishi Sunak had a better comeback.
He ought to spend a bit less time reading that book and a bit more time reading the Deputy Leader's tax advice.
We learned that when I went on the Today programme to talk about Liz Truss, I got confused about my Keiths.
I don't know about Keith Jervis to Margaret Thatcher. She's barely Keith Allen to Orville.
Of course, I meant Keith Harris, so I'd like to apologise to all green birds.
I wish I could fly right up to the sky, but I can't.
You can!
I can't.
And that is what we learned this week. Now, this.
The Columnists.
Patrick McGuire, Times Radio senior political correspondent, has been at Rishi Sunak's big speech this morning on getting more people into work and reducing the cost of sickness benefits. This is what the Prime Minister had to say.
We now spend £69 billion on benefits for people of working age with a disability or health condition. And spending on personal independence payments alone is forecast to increase by more than 50% over the next 4 years. That's not right. It's not sustainable, and it's not fair on the taxpayers who fund it.
What's Patrick, slightly out of the blue, in a week when he's been talking about Rwanda and smoking, why round off the week with the sick notes?
It's an interesting question, Matt, and one that the Prime Minister didn't really answer. We know the numbers the Prime Minister has been talking about, i.e. the rise in the number of people who aren't working, particularly young people, because of health conditions, is increased into the millions since the pandemic. And we know that's concerned the Prime Minister for a long time, but you know, the timing of this speech was pretty curious. But nonetheless, it was something the Prime Minister clearly had put a lot of time and had been thinking about quite hard.
And so what are the solutions? Because everyone knows the problem, particularly since the pandemic, there were a lot more people on out-of-work sickness benefits rather than unemployment benefits. So what is his solution to that?
Well, it was twofold. The first is a sort of cultural critique. And this is the thing the Prime Minister was asked most about. He basically said that the way we think about mental illness in this country has become over-medicalised, and said repeatedly that people who were dealing with everyday struggles, in his words, didn't necessarily need to be signed off work. And now that was the big message he was seeking to get across. He wants to take the power to sign people off work away from GPs and to a new kind of professional. He was asked about the detail of that. He said it would be put out to a consultation. And he was also asked, what about the long-term unemployed? And his new proposal on that is, if you have been on unemployment benefit for 12 months and you haven't accepted an offer of work, you will lose your benefits entirely. Now, he was obviously asked, but hang on, aren't you making people destitute if you do that? And he was nonetheless defiant and said it's a moral issue.
Patrick, what's the time scale on this? Because clearly turning the benefit system around is not an easy, quick fix. And, you know, whichever way you look at it, there's not that long until an election.
Yes, it's unclear, the timing. And it's notable that this, in the first instance, the changes to the personal independence payment paid to people who can't work because of health issues, those proposed changes by Rishi Sunak, i.e. How much people get or the nature of support they get. So if you've got a mental illness now, you might not get money, you might be given treatment instead. That's being put out to a consultation, and we didn't hear anything about the timescale. Now, it may be that this overruns an election, and actually we're seeing a sort of semi-campaign launch from Rishi Sunak here, because clearly the Labour Party is going to balk at some of the ideas in here, not least the idea of, or maybe Liz Kendall, the Blairite shadow working pension secretary, will embrace them all. But I don't think that the Labour Party is likely to swing in behind Rishi Sunak on the question of, say, taking benefits off people entirely, which was what the Prime Minister was talking about in extreme cases today. So maybe that this is the prelude to a big, making welfare a big part of the Conservative electoral pitch, even if we don't see the changes this side of an election.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. Patrick McGuire, Times Radio senior political correspondent, at that speech which Rishi Sunak has been making this morning. So, India Knight isn't here this week, so we have got James Mount. Nice to see you, James.
Good to see you.
And we've got, from the Financial Times, Deputy Opinion Editor Miranda Green. Miranda, what do you make of Rishi Sunak's decision to sort of go on this week in particular?
Well, I think politically, maybe it's kind of trying to get back on board the people in the Conservative Party who weren't mad about the smoking ban, because that did cause a little bit of a split, and maybe the Conservative grassroots aren't so keen on that, what they see as nanny statism side of health policy. And this is today both a kind of, you know, health policy and an economic policy, isn't it? Because all parties recognise, excuse me, frog in my throat this morning, all parties recognise that, you know, the scale of people not working through ill health is actually sort of a key block on getting the economy moving and on the productivity issues. So I think it's very interesting what Patrick was saying as to how Labour might react. And I agree with you both very much that this may be something we see sort of disputed around the manifestos, because there isn't really time to do any of it now. I think also politically, I mean, Conservatives I speak to, they think that Mel Stride, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, is a kind of underused asset and somebody who has been doing a lot of thinking on these kind of structural problems in the benefits system. So I think that's the political sort of side of it. In terms of the substance, I think it's just will be seen by a lot of people as a bit rich to raise this topic without mentioning the crisis in mental health services provision. I mean, if people have mental health issues, they are not getting treatment and they are not getting referrals, particularly young people, because the provision is not there. So If you're going to say, let's get people treated and back into work, okay, fine, but, you know, let's do something about the treatment available.
And actually, quite often, what seems to be the case is that people who start off with perhaps mild mental health problems can't get any help, and so they end up even, you know, their problems worsen, and they end up even further away from the workplace. There's also this weird thing going on, James, where ministers, Mel Stride was doing it, Rishi Sunak was doing a little bit, sort of, I'm not in any way suggesting that some of this mental health stuff is all a bit flaky nonsense, people should put some trousers on and get out of the house. I'm not suggesting that for one moment, while also then saying people should put their trousers on and get out of the house.
Yeah, exactly. I think Miranda's right. This is, you know, signalling to, you know, the kind of Tory base who are maybe more sort of pull your socks up on this issue. I mean, if you look at the polling, I think actually people who think that, you know, being signed off work for mental health is nonsense, it's kind of splits, you know, I think with the public slightly more in sympathy with people who are off work with mental health issues and they think that they're not lying. And obviously the people who think that this is all kind of, you know, wokey snowflake nonsense are very conservative. I think it's a bit of a, the other sort of thing that struck me listening to that Rishi Sunak clip was, you know, that, oh, you just have to deal with the struggles of ordinary life sort of thing does sound a bit off coming from a man who does not seem to have struggled with ordinary life in any way whatsoever. And I don't know, there might be other conservative prime ministers who could have delivered that message a bit more convincingly, but it sort of plays into that out of touch, you don't know what it's like thing to me, I think, with Rishi Sunak.
It's difficult. No,
do you not also both think they've got a bit of a problem with the substance this morning? I mean, when Mel Stride was sort of questioned on the sort of detail of it, it seemed that they were claiming that GPs were doing repeat sick notes to keep people off work without any catch up with the patients, when in fact that wasn't what was happening at all. And apparently experts are saying there isn't actually a rise in sick notes post-pandemic, which I thought was quite surprising. I was expecting that there would have been, for the very good reasons that a lot of people are in dreadful shape.
And actually, then you sort of think, well, are they saying that there were people who are getting sick notes who don't need them, who actually there's nothing wrong with them, they could just be back at work, they're sort of just taking the mick? In which case, why are you then saying, well, we need to do more? So you, either there are more people who are genuinely sick and they need more resources, and which is one thing, or there aren't and there's nothing the matter with them and they need to pull themselves together and the sick notes are perfect. They seem to be trying to, you know, argue two things at once. And it's not a million miles away from then you get to the column that you wrote yesterday, James, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, about the infantilisation of people in their 20s.
Yeah, which is something that I guess has kind of struck me for a while, is the way that, I think I'm a bit older than that now, but I certainly felt it, that if you are a young adult, you kind of don't really feel, I think increasingly don't really feel like an adult. You're kind of stuck. Young adulthood is now being turned, I think, into a kind of extended phase of childhood. You know, you can quite easily be 25 now and living at home with your parents, still in education. I mean, there are lifestyle things, actually, that a psychologist called Jean Twenge points out, that people in young adulthood kind of live a lot more like children, don't drink, don't have sex. And it was a lot of things that I'd sort of, I don't know,
and then you
kind of joined
up. The thing that came out this week, the AA saying that people who are under 25 shouldn't be able to carry people their own age in their car. In their 20, you made the point that if you go back a couple of generations, by 25, people got married and had children and bought a house and
exactly,
running businesses, not driving around with their mother in the back of the car.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this kind of, I don't know, it's this interesting cultural thing where childhood, I think, has been kind of probably for like a century, what counts as a child has been creeping slightly further and further, further up. And yeah, I mean, weirdly, the genesis of this column came ages ago when I was watching the Kanye West documentary Genius. And there's a really interesting bit at the beginning where,
I'll be honest, James, I wouldn't have had you down as a Kanye West
documentary. It was an interesting documentary, although obviously Kanye West has not, you know, weathered particularly well as a, you know, likable cultural figure. Not that he ever was particularly likable. But there's an interesting bit at the beginning of that documentary where I think he's like 16 and commercial, and he's just allowed into this studio and he's just commercially producing records and he's just a teenager. And that sort of struck me as something that I think would really find hard to imagine happening nowadays. Nowadays he'd be forced to do like an internship and wouldn't be viewed as competent. And I was, you know, going back to the history of pop culture, and so much of, you know, if you look back of 20th century, a lot of pop culture, not just singers, but managers and stuff, was made by people really, really, really young. And I think, I don't know, there's been this interesting shift where people in the early 20s are counted more as children than as, you know, competent adults who can just be allowed to go and do stuff.
The numbers on some of, you point out that Pitt the Younger was 24 when he became Prime Minister. Brian Epstein signed the Beatles when he was 27. Orson Welles directed Citizen Kane at 25.
Which is mental. And Steven Spielberg made Jaws at 26. And which means that at some point, like a Hollywood producer handed probably a 24-year-old,
yeah,
like millions and millions of pounds to make a film about a shark. And I think that really just shows how differently we think about young adults.
And you said, you make the point that the idea now of a young filmmaker is Greta Gerwig, who's 40.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree that that is young, but that's a separate point. Miranda, what did you make of this?
Well, I mean, I've got to say, James, I love the idea of you particularly lamenting in a nostalgic way that we don't make child prodigies like we used to. where are all the wunderkinds, says wunderkinds. But no, I mean, that list of people in their 20s allowed to kind of professionally blossom was really, really good. I mean, you left out John Keats, who's my personal favourite, of course. This does seem to be something that's really happening to do with the milestones which transition people to kind of full adulthood being pushed back further and further, and that actually leaves people in a sort of weird developmental limbo in their 20s. You know, if you're not leaving home, if you're not starting a home of your own, a family of your own, you know, and also maybe all of that kind of very embarrassing experimentation that we used to do in the age before smartphones, where you could make a fool of yourself and sort of grow as a person and learn without anybody else sharing the video clips. I do think that might have something to do with it.
But it's also that sort of, I think the finances of it, if you are still in your childhood bedroom, you're relying on your parents for money and having to explain to you coming home and have you done the dishwasher and all those conversations you were still having when you were 14, then it's then I suppose it all sort of leads from there.
Yeah, I think the economics is the fundamental thing. I mean, when I was 25, I was living with my grandma, and you know, as lovely as my grandma is, that didn't really make me feel like a fully fledged adult. And the other thing also is, I really think is demographic, is that, you know, these extraordinary statistics, we forget how young society used to be in general. So the median age of a British person in 1800 was 23, and now it's over 40. And you can just see that in a young society where the average person walking around the street is in their mid-20s, like it just seems a lot older. And maybe you can have a 24-year-old prime minister because he's actually younger than the median, you know, member of the population. Yeah. Whereas now I think in an older society, our view of adulthood has been kind of dragged upwards. It is now like, you know, associated more with kind of middle age, and we kind of view the young as this slightly kind of lesser category, rather than accepting that being young, and which has, you know, maybe more risk-taking and dangerous behaviours, isn't this, you know, thing that has to be regulated. That we should view that as part of adulthood too.
And you actually, there were lots of great lines in it, but the line about the concerning number of young people, adults, who go around watching Disney films and talking about which Harry Potter their house they're in.
Yeah, I mean, the most annoying... Well,
didn't Miriam Margolyes get...
She got in trouble. You definitely can't say that people shouldn't be, you know, loving Harry Potter in their 30s as a Harry Potter actress.
Yeah.
That should be number one. Your PR should instill that in you.
She told them to basically grow up.
Yeah, and stop obsessing over Harry Potter, which I think it's got to be the correct belief, hasn't it? But I think...
Harry Potter house are you in, Miranda?
Well, I've got young daughters, so unfortunately I do know the answer to that, and it's Ravenclaw. But I'd like to sort of defend my... I mean, James, you make such a good case in that piece. It's fantastic. But also, I'd like to defend myself on the basis that I did everything I could to get out of being part of the expedition to Harry Potter world, because I can't think of anything worse.
Oh, do you know what?
There should be an age limit on being allowed to be involved.
I've never read one of the books, and I don't think I've seen one of the films from beginning to end. But Harry Potter World, the studios, is brilliant. It's behind the scenes on making a film. And it's just really interesting about how they did it without me having to actually sit through them.
And isn't it? Well, I know the thing is, now I'm rowing back from my, you know, fun, controversial position. But I suddenly remember now we talk about it that, I mean, maybe I've kind of identified myself as, you know, the problem here. Because I remember when I lived with my grandma when I was 25, I remember sitting in my bedroom rewatching the Harry Potter films and thinking,
grow up.
Okay.
These are actually pretty good. So I've, you know, denounced out of my own mouth, I realise now. What a hypocrite.
You wrote an interesting column, and now you're rowing back on it. Oh, God. Yeah. Well, it was nice while it lasted.
Yeah, I know.
Magnificent.
I offer myself as the, you know, the case study. I denounce myself. I'm the evidence.
Miranda, if we are getting up, we've got jobs, we're going to work and all of that, you've been looking at the commute and how we should be behaving on the commute.
Yes, well, we at the FT did a whole kind of package on how commuting has changed post-pandemic, particularly in the sort of great urban centres. So, you know, I struggle in most days on the Central and Bakerloo line to the FT office. The Bakerloo line essentially is a large clay oven which gradually cooks you. So that's, and that sensation is correct. You are, in fact, like a sort of naan bread in a tandoor when you're on the Bakerloo line in high temperatures. But I sort of think the commuting has become such a sort of dreadful panicky thing and everyone looks so miserable. But, you know, in modern life, particularly with smartphones, we have so few opportunities to just stop and stare into space. I think we should all sort of, you know, do sort of civil disobedience and refuse to work on our commute, just read a good book, stare out the window, look with interest at the people around you and zone out, because it's one of the only kind of liminal spaces that are left. And I think it would be good for us all to not feel we had to be productive on these journeys. I mean, obviously it's much, much different if people have a kind of 2-hour train every morning, but if you've got this precious 35-45 minutes,
if I remember,
just do nothing. There's no opportunity in modern life to do nothing, is there?
Well, in fact, on this subject, because James, as we know, has given up his smartphone, somebody got in touch, Luke, with an email in praise of James Marriott. I would appreciate it. Give my regards to James Marriott when he's next in the studio. I was listening to Times Radio and he spoke about how much his life has been improved by deleting apps like YouTube. I read his article and I made the big step to delete my own sources of brainless doom scrolling. Although difficult at first, the action has revolutionised my life. I'm so much more focused and driven, actually spending my time doing interesting activities. Maybe this is the first small step in a public backlash against the dopamine factories. Keep up the good work. Yours sincerely, Luke.
What an excellent listener.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I hope they're all like that.
I don't know
how
he's emailed us, from which device. I would have preferred if it arrived on parchment.
Yes, on a pigeon.
Yeah, exactly. There we are. And I don't know if you noticed, but Liz Truss has got a book out, but she's in trouble again. Because she might have broken the rules about what you can and can't say when a minister publishes a work after leaving office, and it involves the palace. Well, Sarah Houston, royal editor at Talk TV, is here. So what are the Ratcliffe rules, and has Liz Truss broken them?
Well, the Ratcliffe rules were introduced in the 1970s. They prohibit the publication of content that would breach national security, that would talk about international relations or confidential government business. So Liz Truss, former ministers have to submit their manuscript to the Cabinet Office for approval before it's published. She did that. She did it in good time. She took on board their comments about national security. Where she didn't take on board their comments was where it came to the Queen. Confidential government business, nothing more confidential and sacred than that conversation that takes place between a prime minister and a monarch. And she revealed her conversation with the Queen when she first became prime minister, in which the Queen gave her what many might think was wise advice, which was clearly not heeded, to pace yourself. And she's published that. I mean, I think it's perhaps less alarming and revealing about Liz Truss than her response, which was, why me?
Yeah,
when she heard the news about the Queen's death. But nevertheless, it is a breach of convention.
And then later she gave an interview with one of the world's most boring anecdotes, where she revealed for the first time the Queen's last words to her, which were, I'll see you next week.
Yes.
Which again is like, so what? So, are there any repercussions to upsetting the palace? And the danger is,
well,
we are now talking about it and promoting it again.
Yeah, I mean, she's not the first one to do it. David Cameron, of course, very famously did it when he talked about the Queen purring down the phone after he revealed the result of the Scottish independence referendum. Palace were very unhappy about that. He had to issue a grovelling apology, said he wouldn't repeat the same mistake again. I think he did it a couple of weeks later. Boris Johnson, a few hours into the job, he arrived back in Downing Street and he was heard telling someone that the Queen had said to him, I don't know why anyone would want the job of Prime Minister. And he got a swift telling off from staff that he was going to say these things, say it a little bit more discreetly. Yeah. Tony Blair, in his memoirs, talked actually pretty damagingly, really, about the conversations he'd had at Balmoral after Diana's funeral with the Queen. He said she'd displayed a certain hauteur. I don't know what the repercussions were for him, but it was 14 years before he received an honour. So Liz Truss, not the first, and she won't be the last.
What do you think, Miranda? Should she have done it?
No, I mean, she shouldn't have done it, but given that it's all a bit anodyne, I don't think the roof of the palace is going to fall in, is it?
An exclusive revelation. We can reveal that she said, hello, come in.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, since Liz Truss has decided to sort of declare on every other institution and pillar of the British Constitution and society and politics. You know, maybe she'll return to her earlier Liberal Democrat leanings as a Republican. Who knows
where the
Liz Truss political journey will end up.
Right? James, with your old deputy books editor hat on, you going to read it?
No, although it seems to be selling quite amazingly well. It's still in the Amazon bestsellers, which really surprised me.
I was in a bookshop last night and I said, have you got it? And they said no. They'd had three copies in and they'd flown out the door.
Who's buying it?
I think it's joke purchases. I wanted to buy it because I wanted to use it in my stand-up show tonight. And I think it's people buying it for, like, your other half, just to go, oh, I've got your present. You know, that's the only...
Sales are sale.
Sales are sale, exactly. An ironic sale is still in the till, isn't it?
Well, she's done so many interviews about it, I don't think you need to read it do you?
Miranda Green from the Financial Times and James Barrett from the Times. And, of course, you can read James in the Times every week with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. And with your Times subscription, if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, you can get a bonus episode every weekend. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/bonus podcasts and all the details are there. Up next is the politics of chocolate.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
I got to get some chocolates. What do you recommend?
These are my favourite. Yeah. Maltesers and these, banging.
I'm very proud of that.
The chocolate digestive biscuit. It's the chocolate taste explosion.
I've kicked the hot chocolate habit.
Chocolate digestive biscuits.
Oliver Letwin brought the snacks himself. Viennese biscuits. They're sort of like chocolate sandwich biscuits.
Mm-hmm. Freedom for chocolate oranges is what I say.
The chocolate digestive biscuit.
All the workers have been trying the deep fried Mars bar, so will you do so?
Never eat on camera.
Yeah, we all love a bit of chocolate. But you might have noticed you're paying a lot more for your sweet treats than in years gone by. So what is going on? Let's bring in the consumer journalist, Harry Wallop. Hi, Harry.
Hello, Matt.
So what's behind? We're taking a look at the politics of chocolate, but I feel like we should start with the economics of chocolate. What's going on with chocolate prices?
Well, chocolate prices, in short, have shot up like a rocket in recent months. I mean, obviously, they've been affected along with all other major commodities with general inflation. And anything that's sold in a UK supermarket is affected by the minimum wage, which has gone up now 3 years in a row by, you know, above levels of inflation, and rent and rates and all that, and energy costs. There's a lot of energy and making a chocolate bar, but there's specific issues with chocolate, which means that they're continuing to climb in price, whereas other commodities are calming down, notably wheat. And the issue with chocolate is, in short, cocoa. There's been a terrible series of harvests in the Ivory Coast, And in Ghana, in West Africa, where two-thirds of our chocolate come from. So cocoa prices are, I'm looking at a graph, and it's just, it's alpine, the graph. It looks steeper than the slopes of a Toblerone. It is way higher, way, way higher, about three times higher than it was a year ago.
And actually, I've been sort of reading pieces in the money pages, sort of saying, you know, to start investing in chocolate futures.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could do that. I mean, you might get chocolate on your face in a year's time when they finally come plummeting down. I mean, there is a structural issue with chocolate, which is we expect it to be actually, you know, pretty cheap. It used to be a treat, maybe a weekly treat. We used to have a sweet cupboard at home when I was a child. We could only have sweets after lunch on a Saturday, gosh. But now kids expect chocolate to stuff their face, indeed actually adults, every day. So not enough money has been invested in some of these these cocoa farms. So that is part of the problem. It's going to take a while for this to right itself.
And there's also an issue with supply, if there's the problems with the harvest. But is there sort of the growing middle class in developing countries increasing demand as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, as I say, it's now become a sort of a daily edible consumption pattern rather than an occasional treat. And it is becoming, it's becoming far more global. Absolutely. So with all these things.
So that's the economics of chocolate. Let's talk about the politics of chocolate. We asked YouGov to poll what do you prefer? Milk chocolate, white chocolate or dark chocolates? What did you make of the polling, Howie?
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I thought wishy-washy Lib Dem voters, you know, who can't make their mind up, would just love white chocolate, which isn't really a chocolate at all. It's essentially just fat and sugar and some milk, but not at all. Lib Dem voters are the least likely to like white chocolate, and they're not even hair-shirty dark chocolate people. It's Tories. Tories are the most likely to enjoy dark chocolate. Are these kind of weird Farage sort of Bourneville bar munchers? I don't know. And then it's the Labour voters who are fondest of, it's actually slightly picked by Lib Dems, so milk chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all very fascinating.
So, Lib Dems most likely to like milk, Labour most likely to like white chocolates, 15% of Labour voters, and Tories more likely to like dark chocolate. The thing that sometimes with charts, you're always looking for the difference. The thing that struck me is Remain and Leave, which we think is this great divide in British politics. And these people have nothing in common. Almost exactly the same proportions who like, Remainers who like milk chocolate, the same as Leavers. It's the one thing they agree on.
Yeah, but I bet you if you asked them about brands, there would have been a huge discrepancy. I bet you Tony's Chocolonely would have massively, what the industry called over-index with Remainers. The people who like to bleat on about social justice, they're going to be the ones who are loving Tony's Chocolonely. And maybe the old school kind of Yorkie bars would have found favour with Brexiteers.
And there's a big age split as well. Younger people preferring milk chocolate. And then as you go sort of up the age ranges, dark chocolate really coming in. And a bit of a geographical split as well. Wales, much bigger on the milk chocolate. England, bigger on the dark. So there is, what do you prefer, Harry?
Well, yeah, it's like asking me to name my favourite child, and I've got four children. So I like a bit of everything. I have a slight fondness because I'm a metropolitan elite. I quite like that heavy dark milk chocolate that Green and Blacks do. I think they call it intense, where it's got a higher cocoa content.
That's for people who like the idea of dark chocolate but don't actually like the taste, Harry. That's what you've done there.
Yeah, that's a fair comment. I also like actually, you know, junk chocolate. I mean, if you give me a bag of Minstrels, I'm just gonna gorge on the whole bag. I can't just have one or two Minstrels.
Actually, on the Tony Chocolonely, when we were in Amsterdam last year, you can go to the Tony Chocolonely factory shop and make your own. And you sort of you design your own packet and you do all the flavours of bits and pieces you want to put in it, and you go and pick it up later. And that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's very impressive. I mean, the thing is, they're an incredible company because they came in only 7 or 8 years ago trying to compete with essentially more or less a duopoly between Master Foods, who own Mars and all their sister chocolate bars, and Mondelez, the bastard child of Kraft Foods, who own Cadbury's and all their sister companies. And they've come in and they've been astonishingly successful, sort of being this third chocolate brand in the UK.
Really interesting that. Howie, good to speak to you as ever. Howie Wallop there, consumer journalist and consumer of chocolate. But let's now look at a bit of the history of that, the way that these companies have chopped and changed over the years. Alex Hutchison is a chocolate historian. You, for more than a decade, was the archivist at Nestle UK as well. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
No, it's great to have you. Just on the polling, was there any of a surprise to you? What would be your favourite?
Oh, I love a dark chocolate. The darker, the better. I like 100% dark. But no, it didn't come as a surprise to me. The younger audience do tend to like white chocolate. As you get older, you like something darker.
And tell us then about your time at the Nestlé archive and the history of chocolate arriving in the UK as Howie was saying, it began life as a treat.
It did. Well, chocolate arrived in the UK as a drink, as a very unusual hipster drink. And it arrived just as we were all getting stuck into Restoration Britain and enjoying ourselves. That's when we really started to get into drinking chocolate. And it took a long time for it to become an eating product. It was Fry's down in Bristol who made the first mass-produced bar of eating chocolate. And even that took ages to take off. We didn't become a nation of chocolate bar eaters, really, until after the First World War. So we're late to the chocolate party. But boy, have we got stuck in.
And when Harry was talking about the duopoly now, the two big companies and Tony's Chocolonely coming in underneath, has that always been the case? Or were there far more chocolate businesses as that boom happened, which then got, for the want of a better word, gobbled up by the big boys?
Well, I would say that our chocolate market in the UK was dominated for a very long time by the big three Quakers. That was Roundtree's, Cadbury's and Fry's, and they really did dominate the market. There were smaller players like Terry's, Nestle, initially Peter Caiacola were also selling chocolate in the UK. But we've always had a market dominated by some big boys. It's just that the big boys have changed.
And what about the politics weaving through this? I mean, it was clearly, you know, anyone who's been to Bourneville or the Cadbury factory, there's quite a story there in terms of the lifestyle, the social impact they felt they could have with their employees. You know, then the Roundtrees were a political family, owned the Northern Echo, were involved in politics. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, both Cadbury's and Roundtrees wanted to create model villages and model factories for their workers. They'd had factories in city centres which were polluted and unhealthy working spaces, but also not great for their business. They wanted to move out into the countryside and give their workers much more enjoyable time. They also pioneered a lot of the standard employment legislation that we now see today in the UK. But for me, the most exciting thing that they did was try to make everything better for everybody, not just their employees, but everyone around them. They wanted to
improve their lot.
Improve their lot. I was lost for words there. Improve society. They wanted to improve society, and I just think that's lovely. And yes, one of them was Arnold Roundtree. He was a member of the Roundtree family. He worked in the Roundtree's cocoa works, but he also became an MP during the First World War. He was known as Chocolate Jumbo. And although he wasn't a conscientious objector, he was a pacifist. He decided to stand up for conscientious objectors, even though it won him the nickname in the papers as a chocolate traitor, but he really wanted to make a difference in the world. And I love that.
And what about the role of more recent politics? Britain's relationship with the EU, since leaving the EU, has that changed chocolate?
Well, there has been a long-running battle since the late 1990s over what is chocolate, how much cocoa solids constitutes a chocolate bar. So here in the UK, we're willing to put up with 20% cocoa solids in our milk chocolate bars. And in the EU, they would rather have 25% as their minimum. So if one of our chocolate bars is sold in the EU, it needs to be labelled as family milk chocolate. So if it's got between 20 and 24% cocoa solids, it needs to be family milk chocolate. So we're willing to tolerate rather less cocoa, a lower quality chocolate bar. And I'll be interested to see how that relationship develops and whether or not, in light of the increased cost of cocoa, we decrease the cocoa in our chocolate bars.
But then I remember when it was the big Kraft row was going through and they were trying to buy Cadbury's, there was concern that we might go the way of the Americans, and because theirs is even lower, isn't it? Or there was certainly a fear that our chocolate was going to be more like the American chocolate.
Yes, I've never been a fan of Hershey's myself. It's not just the cocoa content, it's the various other ingredients.
And what they put in it.
Yeah, and the particularly sickly taste of a Hershey chocolate bar. So, yes, I'm always concerned that we'll decrease the amount of cocoa solids in our chocolate bars, but also that we'll shrink them, because, of course, our chocolate bars have been shrinking in the UK. When Kit Kat was first launched in 1935, it weighed 2 ounces, which is about 56 grams. And it's now shrunk by about the size of 1.5 fingers.
Unbelievable.
A four finger Kit Kat.
Wow.
Has gone from 2 ounces.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Right. Now let's take a look at the history, not always positive history, of chocolate. Let's speak to Katie Sampek, Global Professor in Historical Archaeology at the University of Reading. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Hey, Matt. Nice to see you.
Good to have you with us. We all think chocolate is lovely when we buy it in the shops and eat it, but tell us about the process of it getting to our shops and the not always great history of the chocolate industry.
Well, the process of the chocolate getting to your shops is one of, a careful relationship of those farmers with a very delicate tree, and a lot of decision making about how to take care and cultivate that tree so it really grows to its full potential, when to harvest it, how you have to ferment the seeds to be able to get the nibs out that we is what we use to make the chocolate. And all of that involves skilled labor, thoughtful labor, and yet at the same time, that farming has been done for hundreds of years under a very coerced context, where starting with enslaved African labor in the 1600s, it was a really dramatic shift to what people have been doing for centuries before, even thousands of years before, in Mexico, Central America, to grow that same crop.
And so was it literally sort of clearing out what was previously grown for essentially local people to eat in order to grow this strange bean that people elsewhere in the world had got a taste for?
Absolutely. In the case of Africa, that so the origins of the plant are in northern Amazonia, first domesticated probably about 7,000 years ago. And some of the earliest archaeological evidence is from the Mayo Chinchipe region in Ecuador about 5,500 years ago. And the plant eventually finds its way to Mexico and Central America, and other varieties develop. You have a real blossoming of the use of that tree, and the evidence is of lots of different kinds of ways. And it was grown household sort of levels, like in your garden, basically, your house garden. But then a few places became major, major producers of cocoa because of its very special nature. There are only a few places that are really suitable for really high volume production. And so those indigenous people in Mexico and Central America really learned how to cultivate cocoa in this ideal kind of way. And it basically requires that community committing to an agroforest. So it's a lower story. It's a tree that likes to grow underneath other trees, sort of in the dappled shade, and plenty of water, just the right soils, that sort of thing. And so there had been a region where my project is really focused is in Western El Salvador, where they were absolutely spectacular producers and had basically fully bought into this kind of cooperative farming that you have to have for the incredibly high yields that they had, that were comparable to the yields that people are getting today. And so you have this very, very long heritage, this ability to grow massive amounts in a few key places. And when European colonists encounter that, at first, the Spanish just appropriate it and kind of rake in the profits, so to speak, and let indigenous people keep managing their lands and the cultivation on their own terms, so long as they were producing well. And then there was a shock about the time that Europeans really start consuming cocoa as a food or a drink. Was also about the time that these indigenous people are filing legal claims, yeah, and getting some relief, right? And so the Spanish strategy was to establish new plantations in new areas, starting in Costa Rica, Venezuela, Ecuador, and with enslaved labor, and basically making vast plantations of maybe not the same quality. And then it moves to Africa in the 19th century.
And Casey, when we talk about the slave trade, you know, when people, you know, they think of it, you know, it's often cotton, sugar that people have in their minds. How big a part was the chocolate, the cocoa industry in what we view as being the slave trade?
It was significant,
yeah,
because especially in these developing areas, beginning with Ecuador, Venezuela, Costa Rica, those were seen as the prime crop in many ways to make a lot of money pretty quickly. Well, relatively quickly. It takes a few years for cocoa to start producing, but they saw the growth in the global market and they were really trying to basically defund those indigenous producers and move it into Spanish and European hands.
Really interesting. Really interesting. Yeah. Katie, good to speak to you. Katie Sampat there, global professor in historical archaeology at the University of Reading, taking a look at the more distant history of the chocolate industry. Let's bring it right back up to date now. Rounding off, we can't do the politics of chocolate without trying some lovely chocolates. And I'm really pleased that Amarachi Clark, founder of Lou Coco Chocolate, is here in the studio, and that you can hear the rustle. There's a certain rustle. So, Amarachi, tell me about how you got into it, and how is Lou Coco different to other chocolates?
So I got into it 9 years ago now, and it was one of those things where my career just kind of all came together. So I was, at one point, I was the vice president of the National Union of Students, so I was very political. And then I went into international development, working for places like Comic Relief and UNICEF. And all of these things started bubbling inside me. And then all of a sudden, I ran a marathon in San Francisco, got injured, and was like, I need to heal myself with food, let it be chocolate, because I really like chocolate. And then I started to dig deeper into chocolate. How do you make chocolate? Where does chocolate come from? And then all these injustices came out, and all these things started bubbling back, all the politics, all the kind of like social justice part of me came back. I was like, no, 90%, well, two-thirds of what the chocolate we eat comes from West Africa. There are increasing numbers of child and slave labour. The child and slave labour is what is holding up the cocoa supply chain. Now, that's wrong, because we get into the position where we think that's okay, but it's wrong. Yeah. And so I said to myself, right, I've got to do something about this. And so I did. I converted my second bedroom in our two-bedroom flat in Stoke Newington into a chocolate factory. And then went from there, taught myself how to make chocolate, taught myself how to import beans, cocoa beans from smallholder farmers in Central and South America and the Caribbean. Got it seized by DEFRA because they had organic written over the sacks. Anyway, taught myself how to make chocolate, launched that chocolate show, and then that was 9 years ago, and we've just grown it up since then.
And how much do you sell now?
We sell a lot of chocolate. Like, everyone always says to me, we're in a sack of chocolate, how many bars can you get? And I'm like, oh, I don't really know, because we make 50-gram bars, we make 25-gram bars, we make like blocks box of chocolate and stuff like that. So yeah, now we're in our own factory in Bermondsey.
Come on then, in the nicest possible way. Let's get it open.
Right, okay. So I always say start with our 70%. So there you go. So lovely. This is 70% from Dominican Republic.
Nice gold foil on there. Well, it's nice and thin, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's supposed to melt on your mouth. And chocolate is like wine and coffee. Different regions create different flavours. And every time I go anywhere, I always say this because you have to keep saying it. Chocolate isn't what we see in the supermarket.
Yeah, yeah.
It's something totally different. When the beans are roasted properly, when you're paying the farmers properly, you're paying them a living income rather than like a fair trade. I do believe fair trade does really quite a lot. But
do you know what would be even better? If you come in last week when I had a nice bottle of red wine, we were doing wine tasting on the show. That's really good.
Well, you do wine and chocolate pairing.
I bet you do. So,
Yeah. We've worked with the...
Put that in for a works outing. Right, I'm going to clean my palate.
Cleanse your palate. Mm. And then when I say that different regions create different flavours, I want you to compare it with this one. So this is a 60% Haiti.
So what was that? That was 70.
70% Dominican Republic. So now you think of geographically where they're based. So Haiti and Dominican Republic, they share the same landmass. Now I want you to try this and tell me what you're getting from it.
It's much smoother.
Yep.
It's that one was, it was great, but it was quite like aggro.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was quite punchy. Yeah, this is a much...
Yeah.
It's lighter.
You should be getting fig flavours from there.
I was going to say fruity.
Yep. Yeah. And this is where it's grown, how it's fermented, how it's dried. And
so it is like wine.
It is exactly like wine. And this is the chocolate that we should be engaging with.
Yeah.
This is chocolate that has been invested in, the farms have been invested in, farmers are being paid properly.
So the process that you go through is the same.
Not necessarily.
Okay, I was just going to say, is it that it's all the flavours are locked in the beans, or do you then treat it differently later?
Well, the flavours are locked in the beans, and then the farmer might say to us, "Do you know what? These are the flavour profiles," and then it's our job to play detective. So I may make this Haitian, and a chocolate maker somewhere else may make it taste a little bit differently. Because we roast the beans at different times and temperatures.
Do you have wine? Do you have a good year? It's like a Haitian's like really good this year.
Well,
then next year it changes because the weather was different.
Well, consistency isn't necessarily a thing at the moment.
Yeah.
But it used to be. So in Belize there was this one.
Go on, what are we having this one? This is the orange.
Yeah, this is milk. So Belize,
just nice. I like that. So it's 50% milk.
Yeah.
So it's much lighter in colour.
It is much lighter. So one year our Belize came out quite banana-y and that wasn't great. But they're usually quite consistent. Yeah, it is.
So what are the big boys doing to just knock all that interest out?
So you've got a contributor mentioned it previously about underinvestment in farms, not paying living income. And so you've got all those bad things there. And then you could be a great farmer. Your next door neighbour could be an absolute terrible farmer. And then when all your beans all come together, the big boys they burn the beans. It's almost like having burnt toast.
Yeah.
And you get that consistent flavour. So everyone thinks that dark chocolate is supposed to be bitter.
Yeah.
And milk chocolate is supposed to be sickly sweet. But...
That's really good. I could demolish that bar of milk.
Yeah.
It's all really good. But
well, this is 50%. And so when the beans are roasted
really smooth,
properly...
But you're right, it's not sickly.
Yeah, when the beans are roasted properly, you don't have to make it so hardly any sugar.
It's not a proper job, this, is it? I'm sitting around eating lovely, delicious chocolate.
I would like you to try our version of white chocolate. So we call this natural blonde.
Mm.
And so...
God, it's completely...
Yeah.
Now, so it's not the bright white milky bars are on me.
No.
I'd say it's more...
Caramel,
caramacky, fudgy sort of colour.
Yeah, so we don't use white refined sugar, so we use coconut sugar and a fruit from Peru called lacuma to sweeten all of our bars. And this one will taste a lot more caramel. Mm. It's got 40% cocoa in that white chocolate. You won't see that in a chocolate bar on your shelves.
It hasn't got that, like, heartburn.
It won't have that. It won't have that.
Oh, my God. I could just do this all day.
You can have the rest of them as well.
Can you come in every week?
I will, with chocolate.
That's amazing. So, where can people find your chocolate?
So you can find us on our website, which is lucocochocolate.com. On our website as well, you can find all of our stockists, so you can go out and into the wild and buy our stuff as well. So,
that's really
Lucocochocolate.com.
Really good. So that's L-U-Coco. So Lou Coco, Lou Coco Chocolate. And Marcia Clark, really good to see you. Thank you for coming in. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the pod. Don't forget, link your Times subscription to your Apple Podcast login at thetimes.co.uk/bonuspodcasts so you get this weekend's bonus episode. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.